This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I decided to speak on korbanos in general and to develop, based primarily on a classic Shir Das by the Tel Zerov, an understanding as to the general meaning of korbanos. The laws of sacrifices are very intricate, and each sacrifice has its own meaning and its own intent, and as the Rambam says, the korbanos, although they are principles on which the whole world depends, it's something very fundamental. The reasoning and the understanding behind it is something which eludes us. It's something which is completely beyond us. Yet in the Mori Nevuchim, the Rambam suggests a rather controversial reason for the korbanos, which we'll discuss. And I have spoken about aspects of this before. But it's terribly important for two reasons. Number one, so that we have some kind of an approach to the concept of korbanos, and that we realize that it's not some archaic ritual, but that it has a deep spiritual and emotional relevance to us. And it's secondly important because the concept that is developed from this is a concept supremely important in the development of a religious philosophy, particularly nowadays. We're talking really about the most radical and extreme of religious practices. Sacrifice, if we look at it as a religious practice. And we're looking at the most radical and extreme of religious emotions, if we look at it as an emotion, sacrifice in another sense, self-sacrifice. So we're looking in a sense at the most extreme aspect of a religion when we look at korbanos. And we're living in a time of extremities, as we discussed also earlier on, in a different context, where extremities are fashionable. And sometimes extremities are important. Extremities are important, by the way, one has to have them in their right perspective. Firstly, they're important because there's some things one has to feel and act extreme with extremism. And secondly, they're important because they keep the middle. The middle ground is halfway between the two extremes. And if you don't have an extreme, then the middle becomes the extreme. And the middle shifts left or right. So extremes have a place. There always have been extremes and there always will be extremes. And we need extremes. But one has to see the full perspective. And one has to be able to judge one's own position within the extremes. And then there are different types of extremes. There is an extremity or an extremism which is an extremism of purity. That's one kind of person who takes to the absolute ultimate the development and the living of purity, something far beyond that which the ordinary man is able to achieve. Fine. That's a certain type of extremism which one has to have a great deal of respect and kavod for. Sometimes there is an extremism in the meticulous adherence to halacha. That's an extremism that one has to have a great deal of kavod. In Eretz Yisrael, up until 25, 30 years ago, there were two figures who each represented those two extremities. The Brisker Rov, who stood for the extremity of purity, of uncompromising purity, and the Chazon Ish that stood for extremity in Dikduk Halacha, in the precision of the carrying out of Halacha. Those aren't really extremists, those are purists. And there's a difference between an extremist and a purist. Even though a purist might be living a type of life which ordinary people like us find it impossible to live, but we can relate to it, we can understand it, we can admire it. Extremism is and radicalism, that's something cheap. That's something where there is a substitution of depth by lateral extreme. Instead of going deeply into something, there is a tendency sometimes to rather cover the extremities. And in an area such as religion, it becomes easy to confuse extremity with purity. Where there is knowledge and understanding and maturity, one is able to see through it rather quickly. But where there isn't, where there is superficiality and lack of understanding and emotionalism, it's sometimes difficult to tell the differences on the surface between extremism and between purity. And the tendency is always to move to the extreme. If one tends towards the left-wing extreme, then the tendency is to move more and more to the left. If one tends towards the right-wing, the tendency is to move more and more to the right-wing, because that's where the pressure comes from. It is unfortunate that moderation does not exert pressure. And perhaps that's one of the reasons we need extremities. Extremities exert pressures. The pressures that are exerted in life is a polar sort of pressure. It's the two extremes that exert the pressure. In the center point between the two extremes, you are in fact furthest from any pressure point. And that has its own problems. The Rambam says that the reason, in Moreh Nevuchim, says that the reason for the korbanos is to remove avodah zarah from the world, to remove idolatry from the world. Since it was an ancient idolatrous practice to bring sacrifices, Hashem adopted the attitude, let them rather bring sacrifices to me, and that way they'll be weaned off idolatry. That's what the Rambam says, which is a very strange thing to say on the surface, and is attacked by many people. Although, bear in mind that the same Rambam says in the Yad HaChazokeh that sacrifices have no reason that is intelligible to us. But in Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, the Rambam says that the reasons for the korbanos is lakor avodah zarah min ha'olam, to remove idolatry from the world. What does that mean? Can it possibly mean that Hashem introduced the practice of idolatry because the practice of sacrifices because the idolaters practiced it, and he incorporated it into Torah? That would go against everything we understand the Torah to be. That would go against everything that we're taught from the very, very beginning. Why would Hashem want to incorporate an idolatrous practice that has no inherent halachic relevance and meaning, just for the sake of weaning people away from idolatry? That doesn't seem to be the method that the Ribbono Shel Olam usually adopts. So we must say that the fact that it is an idolatrous practice, we've got to question, where do they get it from? Where did the goyim start with korbanos from? How far back do korbanos go? Who brought the first sacrifices? And we find the first recorded sacrifice in the Chumash is Cain and Hevel. But in Chazal we have sacrifices that Adam HaRishon brought. So the origin of sacrifices goes right back to the first man. Was that a mitzvah? Was Adam given a mitzvah to bring sacrifices? No, that wasn't one of his mitzvahs. He was given a mitzvah, he was given one mitzvah. That was the mitzvah of not eating from the Eitz Hadas. But sacrifices wasn't a mitzvah that was given to him, so where did he get that from? We see here an inherent human drive to bring sacrifices. Sacrifices is just a part of human life. And now that sacrifices are considered primitive and archaic and so on, we find other ways of doing it, which we'll discuss. But the need to bring a sacrifice is an inherent drive within the human being. Everybody has it. And that's why you will find that in ancient religions, all of them had sacrifices. All of them used to bring sacrifices. Where did they all get it from? It's such a weird sort of thing to think of. Where does it come from? And it was universal. It was universal because it's inherent in every human being, the drive to bring a sacrifice. What is the drive to bring a sacrifice? The Derech Hashem says near the beginning that man is a unique creation. He's created of a combination of spiritual and physical forces. There are angels in the creation, but they're only spiritual. There are animals and inanimate objects, and vegetables and so on, that are created only with physical. The human being is the only bria, the only creature that is contained that contains both the highest forms of godliness with the lowest forms of the animal in one bria. And the human being, from that unique position, straddles the heights of Shemayim with the depths of the earth. And he's the only being that actually links those two together. He's the link between the spiritual and the physical. And when we talk about the spiritual and the physical, we're not talking about two objects. When we're talking about the spiritual and physical, we're not talking about two places, two points in a frame of reference. When we're talking about the spiritual and physical, we're talking about two enormously powerful forces that pull in opposite direction. There is the physical force that pulls down, and there's the spiritual force that pulls up. And these forces are enormously powerful. These aren't little forces. These aren't insignificant forces by any means. These are koches, these are forces which are so powerful, pulling man in opposite directions. And that is the reason that man is so full of turmoil, so full of tension, so full of conflict. And we like to try and rid ourselves of those conflicts and those tensions. But it's not so easy. There really are only two ways. The resolution of that tension, which is almost impossible, and only very few reach it, or suicide. Either real suicide or what is tantamount to suicide. We can deprive ourselves of so much chayus, of so much of our life force, that we walk around like robots, like zombies, and we operate like automates, and then we might find that we have managed to free ourselves of these tensions. And this is why I said that the subject is so relevant and so important to contemporary Yiddishkeit. Because in our desire to rid ourselves of the tensions which are innate in us, they must be there, we sometimes adopt an attitude to religion, to Shmiras HaMitzvahs, to Musa, which destroys the very cause of those conflicts. Thinking we've now achieved a great deal, now we're comfortable, we don't suffer from those conflicts, and all that's really happened is that we've destroyed the forces of life within us. If we're not alive, there are no conflicts. I told you before, several times, of the two events that had such a profound effect on me. I didn't understand them fully at the time. The one was when a cousin of mine who was engaged came to tell his grandfather, Rebellia, that he was going to spend Shabbos at his cousin's home with his cousin's family. And Rebellia said to him, where are you going to stay? In the home then? Where is she going to stay? So he said, she's also staying in the home for Shabbos, but everybody, the parents are there, the children are there, it's a full home on Shabbos, there's no problem. And Rebellia looked at him straight in the eye and said, you're a young man, and you're engaged, and for a Shabbos you're going to go and spend the Shabbos in your color's home, and you're not afraid of the kind of thoughts you're going to have and where and of your whole spiritual state, it doesn't bother you, you're not scared. And he laughed, he said, no, nothing, please, Shabbos, the whole family's there, there's nothing to worry about. Zayda, he said. And Rebellia took out a piece of paper, and he said, your mother's name again? Your name? Your mother's name? And he said, what do you need my mother's name? He said, you're sick. There's something wrong with you. A young man of your age, engaged, you're going to spend the Shabbos, your colors, and you're not worried about what your thoughts will be. There's something wrong with you. I need to daven. I need to pray for your recovery. And the second one, Rebellia saying to me, once when I came to ask him if he needed anything in town, I was going to Haifa one Friday afternoon, and he said, you're going to Haifa? You're not scared? And I thought there'd been something on the news that I hadn't heard about. There'd been an explosion there or something. I said, scared? Scared of what? And he said, you're just prepared to walk around in the streets of Haifa? You're not scared? I said, scared of what? He said, I'm nearly 90, and I've only got sight in one eye, and I would be scared to go to Haifa. You're a young man, and you can see with two eyes, and you're not scared to go to Haifa? We dull ourselves, and we deaden ourselves to the point that we're not scared. That the tensions don't bother us. And we think we're clever, we're frum now. No, go to Haifa without being scared. We think we're frum. That's not called being frum, that's called being dead. And we're finding a difference, difficult a little bit nowadays, to discriminate between being frum and being dead. Very difficult. And we're producing deathly robots, and we're calling them frum. And we're teaching these robots how to do all the frum things that frum people do, and we're dressing them up in very frum garb, and we're letting them out, we're letting them loose, and we're calling them frum. A frum robot, yes, but not a frum human being necessarily. A frum human being has tensions and he has conflicts, and his whole life is filled with the conquest of those conflicts, the handling of those conflicts. Sometimes he wins, sometimes he loses, sometimes he's up, sometimes he's down, but he handles them and he works with them. He doesn't deny them. These two forces, the force of spirituality pulling us upwards and the force of the physical pulling us downwards, and we're stuck in the middle trying to cope with these two forces and with their effects on us. I think I told you also of the case when I led a campaign in Gates of Yeshiva against the kitchen staff who were producing the kind of food which I doubted was qualified for making a brocha. And eventually, when out of frustration, I took my portion over across the road to the Rosh Yeshiva, to my uncle, and I said, "You tell me if I can make a brocha. I've come to ask a shayla. You tell me. You've eaten already. Your wife made you the kind of food that you can make a brocha on. So you've eaten. So you can taste to tell me whether I can make a brocha. I can't taste because I don't know what to do." So he tasted. He said, "No, he doesn't think he can make a brocha on it." And he walked over to the yeshiva immediately, and he walked into the kitchen. And then he called the boys from his shiur, because I was in a junior shiur at the time. And he asked them what they thought about the food in the yeshiva. And most of them answered, they didn't come to yeshiva for food. If they wanted food, they could have stayed at home. They've come to learn, and their head is in the learning, and really the food doesn't make much difference to them. And he said, "In that case, I think you'd better find yourselves another yeshiva. This yeshiva is designed for human beings, not for angels." There's a recognition on the part of anybody who's occupied in life, no matter how high up the scale of life he's occupied, that life means living. And living means real life, not denying that part of life which is the chayus, which is the life force in the human being. And the human being, finding himself pressurized by these two forces that are exerting this pull upon him, can either allow himself to be torn into pieces, or he can cut himself off from the physical, which means killing himself in one form or another, or he can cut himself off from the spiritual, which means killing himself in another way. Those are the ways that we know how to handle it, really. Most of society handles it in one of those ways. They either try to deny the physical, and the Catholic religion has tried that sort of route, or to deny the spiritual, and most people try that sort of route, or they need to be able to function in a way which either brings the spiritual down to the physical or raises the physical up to the spiritual. To be pulled in these opposite directions, if we're going to go in one of the directions, we're going to take something with us. And we're either going to elevate the physical or we're going to bring down the spiritual. But we cannot remain attached to both spiritual and physical forces, pulling in opposite directions, and not move or affect either force. When we move, one of those forces move with us. And if we choose to move in the direction of spirituality, yet remain attached to materialism, to matter, then we are going to elevate matter with our move. And that is the inherent drive which is in the human being. That drive to elevate matter. To seek every possible way to elevate matter as a means of resolving his enormous conflict. He can't stay where he is, and he's not willing to release his hold on the spiritual. He wants to move up. And his only method then of moving up is to take matter with him, to elevate the material. And the idea of the sacrifice is to take the material, but not the inanimate material, because the sacrifice is there to deal with living conflicts, with real conflicts, with a conflict caused by the clash between the spirit and the animal within us. So sacrifices have always been animals primarily. We take an animal representative of that animal force and we elevate it on a mizbeach. We bring it and we elevate it. Which is something that we do not only with straight sacrifices, but even the way we do shechita is an act of elevation. Now, I've mentioned also before the observation that was made by Thomas Mann, who was a goy, and many others, that although in most non-Jewish societies the slaughterer is the bottom of the barrel of society, he's usually a real nobody, somebody who can't find any other job. And a shochet is always a fine person, a spiritual person, very often a Talmid Chochem. The amount of learning he needs to become a shochet, the care and the precision and the concern that he needs, he's usually a community leader, a shochet. Because he's not involved in the destruction of animal life. He's involved in the elevation of animal life. To take an animal and to operate or subject it to the shechita operation is an act of elevation. That's not an act of destruction. I remember when I was learning shechita, trying to put off the first visit to the abattoirs, because I knew that after I'd been to the abattoirs for the first time, firstly it would take me a long time to get myself back again, and secondly I would be off meat for a long time. And we didn't get that much to eat in yeshiva, so to be off the little bit of meat that they gave us wasn't a good idea. So I tried to postpone it. And it never happened. When I came back from the abattoirs, I enjoyed meat more than I'd ever enjoyed it before, because I saw how it was done. The precision, the care, the love, the spirituality, the upliftment. It was an experience of exaltation. It wasn't an experience of disgust at all. That's shechita. And how much more so was the avodas beis hamikdash. If our ordinary shechita, shechting animals for ordinary consumption, is an elevating action and an elevating experience both for the human being and for the animal, how much more so the avodah on the beis hamikdash, which included not only the shechita, but several other acts of avodah that had to take place with the same kind of precision, with the same kind of dedication, leading up ultimately to the bringing of parts of the animal onto the elevated part of the beis, of the mizbeach, of the altar, and being brought up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. An important part of the korban was also that it was consumed by kohanim, that it was consumed, parts of it were consumed by people dedicated to the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. All that is an aliyah for the animal. All that is an elevation, not only for that animal. That's not what we're talking about, just to elevate that animal. But through the elevation of that animal, one is elevating the animal world, and the animal world includes the animal which is within inside us. That part is included. And through the act of that elevation, we find that not only is that animal or is the objective animal elevated, but the subjective animal is elevated too. And that's why there has been an innate drive in society and humanity since the beginning of all time to bring korbanos as an act not only of ritual, as an act not only of expression, but as an act of the elevation of that which is material, of the elevation of that which is animal, in order to try and resolve this tension and try and ease this enormous conflict that preoccupies us, the conflict between the spiritual and the physical. And it should not be seen that a korban is the destruction of the animal. You might say, good, so how do we elevate the animal? By destroying him, by shechting him. That's also not a fully correct picture, and to say that therefore we must destroy the animal within us. That's a conclusion that one might be led to from a korban. Firstly, as we've said, a korban is not destruction of the animal. God hunting, that's a destruction of an animal. And that's why hunting has such completely a different effect on a person from the act of shechita, from the act of slaughtering. It's not the same. That's something that the SPCA and its recent furor in South Africa about shechita, I don't know if it was pointed out to them or if they would have been able to perceive it. You've probably got to be a bit of a mensch to perceive it as well. It's all very well looking at the effect of slaughtering on the animals. But one has to also look at the effect of slaughtering on the human being. And just as there is an SPCA that worries about what happens to the animal, there should be an SPHA that worries about what happens to the human being. Is it right to subject a human being to the act of slaughtering animals as his parnosis, his regular day-to-day activities? And that's a different thing that has to be concentrated on too. It's not only the animal that has to be cared about, human beings also have to be cared about. The act of elevation of the physical rather than destruction of the physical. We are destroying something. When we shecht the animal, we are destroying the animal's effect of pulling us down. The power of the animal is being destroyed, but not the animal itself. The Tzelzer Rav brings the beautiful Gemara in Avodah Zarah. A difficult Gemara, one that has to be understood carefully, one which, if it weren't in the Gemara and it were told by somebody today, nobody would believe it. Maise b'Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel shehoyo al gabi maile b'har habayis. There was a case with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was standing on an elevated place at the har habayis in Yerushalayim near the Beis Hamikdash. V'ro'o oivedes kechovim achas no b'yoseh. And all of a sudden he saw the most beautiful non-Jewish girl. Happened. A funny place to happen, or the funny person, but it happened. What do you expect him to do? Omar, he said, Mor Rabu Ma'asecha Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam. What beauty. How wonderful are your creations. Shimon Gamliel. V'yach Rabbi Akiva, and even the same happened to Rabbi Akiva. Ro'o Eishes Torunus Rufus HaRosho. He saw, and she was married, never mind a non-Jewish girl, she's a married non-Jewish girl, married to Tonus Rufus. Noah B'Yosef, exceptionally beautiful. Rok, Sochak Uvocha. He expressed three different emotions simultaneously. He spat, and he laughed, and he cried. Rok, he spat, Shehoiso Bo Mitipo Surucho. He spat because he felt disgusted that he was impressed with such beauty, which after all was really just a bit of DNA and water and a couple of chemicals. What is a human being after all? It's so excited about a human being. What is it? Nothing. Sochak, he laughed. The Osido de Megaira Venasiglo. Because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that she was going to convert and he was going to marry her. Bocho, he cried. The high shufro boli afro, that such beauty will one day be buried in the ground and will decay. Gemara goes on to ask, but how do they look? Ulistakulim yushari, since when are you allowed to look at beautiful girls? And the Gemara says, Keren zovis havai. They were walking down a street, and in these narrow streets like in Yerushalayim today, when you come to a crossroad, you don't have a chance to look left and right before you come to the crossroad because they're walls right until the corners. You've got it's all houses right on the corners. There's no way of looking across the diagonal. So you come to the corner, and you look left and right to see. And as he looked left, there she was. There was no chance to avoid her. Nothing right. There she was, right in front of him. There's nothing he could do. So clearly we see that although this confrontation brought them to great spiritual heights, they weren't permitted to voluntarily put themselves in that position. We today, in the kind of lives that we live, our problem is that we're in a Keren Zavis all the time. We're on a corner all the time. If we're going to live the kind of life, so it's a question whether we're allowed to live this kind of life. Good, fine. That's a different issue. Whether we shouldn't live in a society which operates on a frum basis altogether. And although we've always said it's impossible, when the Ayatollah came to Iran, he showed them it's quite possible. And everybody said it can't last for long. You can't run a country as if it comes from the Middle Ages. But it's still going fine. And they're doing all right. And they've got the whole world around their little fingers. And they're managing to run the world like it used to be in the Middle Ages. So it's not so simple that you can't run a society on strictly frum basis. It's only we Jews who believe that you can't run a society on a strictly frum basis. But Lamaisa, you can. And one should. But where it isn't so, where that isn't the case, Lamaisa, we're in a Keren Zovis situation all the time. And now comes the difficulty. So that doesn't justify our involving ourselves in things which we're not allowed to be involved in. But nevertheless, and bear in mind too, and this is why I said this is a difficult Gemara. We're talking about Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and we're talking about Rabbi Akiva. We're not talking about important people. But the Gemara reports this, and this is included as part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, because there's a principle here which needs to be understood and which needs to be lived. And the principle is you don't resolve tension by denying it. You don't resolve tension by pretending that the cause is not there. You don't resolve tension by running away from it. There's a different way of handling it. And what's important to see here is not so much what Rabbi Akiva did and what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel did. Because we couldn't do the same, we're not on that level. But what's important to see that after a lifetime dedicated to Torah and Mitzvahs, on the levels of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, at a moment when they were standing on a Milo and Har HaBayis, they were up, look where they were, in Yerushalayim. The greatest of our great people at a time of greatness, in a place of greatness, of Kedusha V'Tahara. And they're confronted with a situation where opposite them there's a beautiful non-Jewish woman. One would think they wouldn't even notice. Keren Zavis or not Keren Zavis, one would think their minds are somewhere else. That they have spiritualized themselves to such a level that it has no impact on them. That's where we see we're wrong. It has enormous impact on them, much more than an ordinary person would experience. And if our perception of Torah is such that we think that a Rabbi Akiva and a Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel would not be affected by that confrontation, then our perception of Torah is wrong. That's what we have to understand. That Torah is not meant to produce people who are desensitized. Torah is not meant to produce people who don't have the conflict within themselves, who are not battling and struggling with the conflict within themselves, who don't feel the pulls and the pushes in every direction. That's not what Torah is meant to do. Torah is meant to produce people who, when confronted with it, are able to elevate it, are able to use it to come closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam, not to draw themselves further away from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It tells Rav as a beautiful explanation of the posuk of Tomim Tiyu Im Hashem Elokecha, Tiyu Im Hashem Elokecha. You shall be perfect with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he says there are two aspects to perfection. Perfection means that your whole being should be perfect. You're not missing a leg, you're not missing an arm, you're not missing an eye. Nor are you missing any feeling, any emotion. Nor are you feeling any basic human drive. That you're complete with all your drives, with all your emotions, with all your feelings. That's part of Tomim Tiyu. And the Telzerov has a shita that firstly he holds that it is impossible to totally destroy any of the human drives. And if one thinks one has destroyed it, one hasn't. It will break out somewhere else. And if theoretically it was possible to destroy a human drive, he holds that's part of suicide. One isn't permitted to do that. That's killing a part of yourself. And he says, apart from Tonim Tiyu Hashem Im Hashem Elokecha, that we are obligated to be complete. Complete in our bodies, complete in our minds, complete in our physical drives and spiritual drives, complete in our feelings and sensitivities. All that is part of our completion. But it has to be Im Hashem Elokecha. It's like taking a beautiful machine, you can take a computer, and it's Tomim, it's complete. It's the hardware is complete and the software is complete and it can do all sorts of things. There's nothing missing. But it's not plugged in. If it's not plugged in, it can't do anything. So it is with Tomim Tiyu Im Hashem Elokecha. We have to be complete with all our drives, but we have to be plugged into the Ribbono Shel Olam. That all those drives and all those pressures and all those feelings and all those sensitivities do arouse feelings in us. And that we do feel ourselves constantly alive and constantly subject to these pressures. But the result of that pressure is, an Im Hashem Elokecha, we feel closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. When we see something beautiful, whether it's a beautiful piece of scenery, whether it's a beautiful work of art, whether it's a beautiful piece of music, or whether it's a beautiful human being, we feel it, we acknowledge that within ourselves. But the feeling results not in emotions of negativism and destructiveness, but in emotions of elevated thoughts, of becoming closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Morabu ma'asecho Hashem. Can you imagine any other human being feeling these three feelings when confronted with beauty? Think of people who consider themselves to be really sensitive to human beauty. Can you imagine them being brought to tears by the fact that that beauty is ultimately going to decay, is going to be buried? Tears. Bocho, Rabbi Akiva is crying at the same time as he's laughing and spitting. All these three different emotions working inside him. But they're emotions that bring him closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're emotions that make him feel closer to sanctity, not to take him further from sanctity. So when we talk about a korban, meaning the elevation of the physical force, that's exactly what we mean. Elevating the physical force, not chas v'sholem destroying the physical force. Keeping the physical forces intact, but directing them, purifying them, elevating them. That's what a korban means. That's what a sacrifice means. To sacrifice the downward pulls in favor of the upward pulls. That's what it means to sacrifice, to be make a korban. And what does lahakriv mean? What does a korban mean? A drawing near. Korban does not mean distraction. Korban does not mean slaughtering. Korban means to bring near. To take something animal and to be makriv it, to bring it nearer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. To take something which is inherently so low and to elevate it to a position of spiritual height. And that says the tells it all uses this principle in many areas. The one area that he uses it is to explain the fact that Yitzchok had to ask Esav to bring him some food before he gave him a brocha. And he asks Yitzchok Avinu, a man of such kedusha and taira, a man whose thoughts are in such high spiritual levels, and is old and is about to die, and wants to give a brocha to his son. Why doesn't he recall in Esav and learn chavrusa with him a little bit and then give him a brocha? Calls in, tells him to make him some food, delicious, just the way he likes it, and bring me the food, then I'll give you a brocha. And the Telzerov shows how there too, even a man of the great heights of the Yitzchak Avinu, wanted to give that brocha with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his body too. He wanted every power and every drive within him to be working for that brocha. His mind he could direct. His soul he could direct, but for his body also to participate in that brocha, the body also had to feel gratification. The body also had to feel a certain pleasure and a sense of gratitude to Esav and a desire to want to do good for Esav. And so he satisfies the body's needs too. He doesn't deny it. He doesn't say, I don't taste food. I'm an old man. I can't tell the difference. Not at all. He tells Esav to bring him tasty food of just the type that he likes, so that that can stimulate him into giving the bracha that he requires. And that's our Birkas Hanenim. When we make brachas too, we're using the food as a means of elevating our own selves, the physical part of ourselves and the spiritual part of ourselves, using that, using the pleasure that it brings us, and it's meant to bring us pleasure, using that pleasure to be mevarech the Ribbono Shel Olam, to express our gratitude and our praise for the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so we see that the act of korban, although it is an extremity or an extremism, it is something radical. Korban, sacrifice, killing an animal for the purpose of a religious ritual. We see also, by just very superficially scratching on the surface, that the meaning and the understanding of that korban is deep, that the meaning and the understanding of that korban is relevant, and that its message primarily is not one of extremity and of radicalism, but one of depth, one of understanding, one of appreciating that everything that the Ribbono Shel Olam created within us has been created to be used. It has been created to be used not for our own good only, and not for the environment in which we live, but it's been created to be used in the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And all these forces and all these powers that exist within the human being, the spiritual ones and the physical ones, each one of them has a part to play in the Avodas Hashem. That we have to live with all of them alert, powerful and fresh, so that we can be tomim, we can be complete, we can be whole with our entire bodies, minds, human drives, emotions and feelings all intact. But not only tomim, but also tomim im Hashem Elokecha, that perfection should be with the Ribbono Shel Olam and dedicated to His service.